Chapter 55. Thinking about to spread these three or four armless things out into 2 months of daily sneers and affronts. The whole offense, boiled down, amounts to just this. One uncourteous remark of the Tribune about my book knocked me between November 1 and December 20, and a couple of foreign criticisms of my writings knocked me between November 1 and Jan 26. If I can't stand that amount of friction, I certainly need reconstruction. Further boiled down, this vast outpouring of malice amounts to simply this. One just from the Tribune, one can make nothing more serious than that out of it. One jest, and that is all. For the foreign criticisms do not count, they being matters of news, and proper for publication in anybody's newspaper. And to offset that one jest, the Tribune paid me one compliment December 23, by publishing my note declining the New York New England dinner, while merely in the same breath, mentioning that similar letters were read from General Sherman, and other men whom we all know to be persons of real consequence. Well, my mountain has brought forth its mouse, and a sufficiently small mouse it is, God knows. And my 3 weeks' hard work have got to go into the ignominious pigeonhole. Confound it, I could have earned $10,000 with infinitely less trouble. However, I shouldn't have done it, for I am too lazy now, in my sere and yellow leaf, to be willing to work for anything but love. I kind of envy you people who are permitted for your righteousness' sake to dwell in a boarding house. Not that I should always want to live in one, but I should like the change occasionally from this housekeeping slavery to that wild independence. A life of don't care a damn in a boarding house is what I have asked for in many a secret prayer. I shall come by and require of you what you have offered me there. Yours ever, Mark. Howells, who had already known something of the gathering storm, replied, "Colin, your letter was an immense relief to me, for although I had an abiding faith that you would get sick of your enterprise, I wasn't easy until I knew that you had given it up." Joel Chandler Harris appears again in the letters of this period. Twitchell, during a trip south about this time, had called on Harris with some sort of proposition or suggestion from Clemens that Harris appear with him in public and tell, or read, the Remus stories from the platform. But Harris was abnormally diffident. Clemens later pronounced him the shyest full-grown man he had ever met, and the word which Twitchell brought home evidently did not encourage the platform idea. To Joel Chandler Harris, in Atlanta. Hartford, Apple. 282. Private. "My dear Mr. Harris, Joe Twitchell brought me your note and told me of his talk with you. He said you didn't believe you would ever be able to muster a sufficiency of reckless daring to make you comfortable and at ease before an audience. Well, I have thought out a device whereby I believe we can get around that difficulty. I will explain when I see you. Joe says you want to go to Canada within a month, or 6 weeks, I forget just exactly what he did say, but he intimated the trip could be delayed a while, if necessary. If this is so, suppose you meet Osgood and me in New Orleans early in May, say somewhere between the 1st and 6th? It will be well worth your while to do this, because the author who goes to Canada unposted will not know what course to pursue to secure copyright when he gets there. He will find himself in a hopeless confusion as to what is the correct thing to do. Now Osgood is the only man in America who can lay out your course for you and tell you exactly what to do. Therefore, you just come to New Orleans and have a talk with him. Our idea is to strike across lots and reach St. Louis the 20th of April. Thence we propose to drift southward, stopping at some town a few hours or a night, every day, and making notes. To escape the interviewers, I shall follow my usual course and use a fictitious name. 150. Samuel, of New York. I don't know what Osgood's name will be, but he can't use his own. If you see your way to meet us in New Orleans, drop me a line now, and as we approach that city I will telegraph you what day we shall arrive there. I would go to Atlanta if I could, but shan't be able. We shall go back up the river to St. Paul, and thence by rail X-Lots home. I am making this letter so dreadfully private and confidential, because my movements must be kept secret, else I shan't be able to pick up the kind of book material I want. If you are diffident, I suspect that you ought to let Osgood be your magazine agent. He makes those people pay 3 or 4 times as much as an article is worth, whereas I never had the cheek to make them pay more than double. Yours sincerely, S50. Clemens. Why backwardness is an affliction, wrote Harris. The ordeal of appearing on the stage would be a terrible one, but my experience is that when a diffident man does become familiar with his surroundings, he has more impudence than his neighbors. Extremes meet. He was sorely tempted, but his courage became as water at the thought of footlights and assembled listeners. Once in New York, he appears to have been caught unawares at a tile club dinner and made to tell a story, but his agony was such that at the prospect of a similar ordeal in Boston, he avoided that city and headed straight for Georgia and safety. The New Orleans excursion with Osgood, as planned by Clemens, proved a great success. The little party took the steamer Gold Dust from St. Louis downriver toward New Orleans. Clemens was quickly recognized, of course, and his assumed name laid aside. The author of Gleary Mus made the trip to New Orleans. George W. Cable was there at the time, and we may believe that in the company of Mark Twain and Osgood those Southern authors passed 2 or 3 delightful days. Clemens also met his old teacher Bixby in New Orleans, and came back up the river with him, spending most of his time in the pilot house, as in the old days. It was a glorious trip, and, reaching St. Louis, he continued it northward, stopping off at Hannibal and Quincy. To Mrs. Clemens, in Hartford. Quincy, ill. May 17, 82. Livy darling, I am desperately homesick. But I have promised Osgood, and must stick it out, otherwise I would take the train at once, and break for home. I have spent 3 delightful days in Hannibal, loitering around all day long, examining the old localities and talking with the grayheads who were boys and girls with me 30 or 40 years ago. It has been a moving time. I spent my nights with John and Helen Garth, 3 miles from town, in their spacious and beautiful house. They were children with me, and afterwards schoolmates. Now they have a daughter 19 or 20 years old. Spent an hour, yesterday, with A.W. Lamb, who was not married, when I saw him last. He married a young lady whom I knew. And now I have been talking with their grown-up sons and daughters. Lieutenant Hickman, the spruce young handsomely uniformed volunteer of 1846, called on me a grizzly elephantine patriarch of 65 now, his grace all vanished. That world which I knew in its blossoming youth is old, and bowed and melancholy now, its soft cheeks are leathery and wrinkled, the fire is gone out in its eyes, and the spring from its step. It will be dust and ashes when I come again. I have been clasping hands with the moribund and usually they said, it is for the last time. Now I am underway again, upon this hideous trip to St. Paul, with a heart brimming full of thoughts and images of you, and Susie and Bay and the peerless John. And so good night, my love. SAML. Clemens' trip had been saddened by learning, in New Orleans, the news of the death of Dr. John Brown, of Edinburgh. To Dr. Brown's son, whom he had known as Ock, he wrote immediately on his return to Hartford. To Mr. John Brown, in Edinburgh, Hartford, June 1, 1882. My dear Mr. Brown, I was 3,000 miles from home, at breakfast in New Orleans, when the damp morning paper revealed the sorrowful news among the cable dispatches. There was no place in America, however remote, or however rich, or poor, high or humble, where words of mourning for your father were not uttered that morning, for his works had made him known, and loved all over the land. To Mrs. Clemens and me, the loss is personal, and our grief the grief one feels for one who was peculiarly near and dear. Mrs. Clemens has never ceased to express regret that we came away from England the last time without going to see him, and often we have since projected a voyage across the Atlantic for the sole purpose of taking him by the hand, and looking into his kind eyes once more, before he should be called to his rest. We both thank you greatly for the Edinburgh papers which you sent. My wife and I join in affectionate remembrances, and greetings to yourself and your aunt, and in the sincere tender of our sympathies. Faithfully yours, S50. Clemens. Our Susie is still Eagleups. He gave her that name. Can you spare a photograph of your father? We have none, but the one taken in a group with ourselves. William Dean Howells, at the age of 45. Reached what many still regard as highest point of achievement in American realism. His novel, The Rise of Silas Lapham, which was running as a century serial during the summer of 1882, attracted wide attention, and upon its issue in book form took first place among his published novels. Mark Twain, to the end of his life, loved all that Howells wrote. Once, long afterward, he said, "Most authors give us glimpses of a radiant moon, but Howells' moon shines and sails all night long." When the installments of The Rise of Silas Lapham began to appear, he overflowed in adjectives, the sincerity of which we need not doubt, in view of his quite open criticisms of the author's reading delivery. To W.D. Howells, in Belmont, Mass. "My dear Howells, I am in a state of wild enthusiasm over this July installment of your story. It's perfectly dazzling, it's masterly incomparable. Yet I heard you read it without losing my balance. Well, the difference between your reading and your writing is remarkable. I mean, in the effects produced and the impression left behind. Why, the one is to the other as is one of Joe Twitchell's yarns repeated by a somnambulist. Goodness gracious, you read me a chapter, and it is a gentle pearly dawn, with a sprinkle of faint stars in it. But by and by I strike it in print, and shout to myself, 'God bless us, how has that pallid former spectacle been turned into these gorgeous sunset splendors?' Well, I don't care how much you read your truck to me, you can't permanently damage it for me that way. It is always perfectly fresh and dazzling when I come on it in the magazine. Of course I recognize the form of it as being familiar, but that is all. That is, I remember it as pyrotechnic figures which you set up before me, dead and cold, but ready for the match, and now I see them touched off, and all ablaze with blinding fires. You can read, if you want to, but you don't read worth a damn. I know you can read, because your readings of Cable and your repeatings of the German doctor's remarks prove that. That's the best drunk scene, because the truest that I ever read. There are touches in it that I never saw any writer take note of before, and they are set before the reader with amazing accuracy. How very drunk, and how recently drunk, and how altogether admirably drunk you must have been to enable you to contrive that masterpiece. Why, I didn't notice that religious interview between Marcia and Mrs. Halleck was so deliciously humorous when you read it to me, but dear me, it's just too lovely for anything. Wrote Clark to collar it for the library. Hang it, I know where the mystery is now. When you are reading, you glide right along, and I don't get a chance to let the thing soak home. But when I catch it in the magazine, I give a page 20 or 30 minutes in which to gently and thoroughly filter into me. Your humor is so very subtle and elusive. Well, often it's just a vanishing breath of perfume which a body isn't certain he smelled till he stops and takes another smell, whereas you can smell other remainder obliterated. Among Mark Twain's old schoolmates in Hannibal was little Helen Kercheval, for whom in those early days he had a very tender spot indeed. But she married another schoolmate, John Garth, who in time became a banker, highly respected and a great influence. John and Helen Garth have already been mentioned in the letter of May 17th. To John Garth, in Hannibal. Hartford, July 3, 1882. Dear John, your letter of June 9 arrived just one day after we ought to have been in Elmira, NY for the summer. But at the last moment the baby was seized with scarlet fever. I had to telegraph and counterman the order for a special sleeping car. And in fact we all had to fly around in a lively way and undo the patient preparations of weeks, rehabilitate the dismantled house, unpack the trunks, and so on. A couple of days later, the eldest child was taken down with so fierce a fever that she was soon delirious, not scarlet fever, however. Next, I myself was stretched on the bed with three diseases at once, and all of them fatal. But I never did care for fatal diseases, if I could only have privacy and room to express myself concerning them. We gave early warning, and of course nobody has entered the house in all this time, but one or two reckless old bachelors, and they probably wanted to carry the disease to the children of former flames of theirs. The house is still in quarantine, and must remain so for a week or two yet, at which time we are hoping to leave for Elmira. Always your friend S50. Clemens. By the end of summer, Howells was in Europe, and Clemens, in Elmira, was trying to finish his Miss Sissaby book, which was giving him a great deal of trouble. It was usually so with his non-fiction books. His interest in them was not cumulative. He was prone to grow weary of them, while the menace of his publisher's contract was maddening. Howells' letters, meant to be comforting, or at least entertaining, did not always contribute to his peace of mind. The Library of American Humor which they had planned was an added burden. Before sailing, Howells had written, "Do you suppose you can do your share of the reading at Elmira, while you are writing at the Miss Sissaby book?" In a letter from London, Howells writes of the good times he is having over there with Osgood, Hutton, John Hay, Eldridge, and Alma Tadema, excursioning to Oxford, feasting, especially, tea the mitter. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.